Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hello and welcome to the Midweek Takeaway. Today we're delighted to be joined by Sapan Ghai, CCO of Sovereign Metals. Welcome back to the podcast, Sapan.
Thank you for having me, gents.
Yeah, absolutely. So we just saw the news that Sovereign Metals has signed a non-binding MOU with Malawi's electricity provider, Eskom, to secure 60 megawatts of grid-supplied hydropower for its Kasia Rutile graphite project, including a planned 132 kilovolt transmission line to Nkoma substation. The agreement aligns with the World Bank's $350 million grant for the $1.5 billion Mapatanga hydropower storage project, which will add 358 megawatts by 2030. Kasia is set to become the world's largest producer of natural rutile and graphite at steady state. Tell us more about this MOU, please, Sapan.
Sure, Phil. Look, we're working towards a definitive feasibility study, DFS, by Q4 this year. The D in that DFS, the definitive part, is very important to us. We want to get to that feasibility study and not have any concerns around infrastructure, logistics, power. Obviously, geologically, operationally, processing-wise, marketing-wise, we're pretty happy where we are following the optimized PFS. So one of the key things we wanted to get definitive about was the power situation. And we signed this MOU with Eskom, Electricity Supply Corporation of Malawi, not to be confused with the Eskom in South Africa. And what the MOU does is it basically lays the framework for us to sign up to future definitive agreements around project implementation, which will include the construction and installation of that new overhead power line that connects us into the national grid at the Nkoma substation. That grid is 98% hydropower today. So we know that we will be 98% renewable energy powered. The MOU also lays out the pathway to a supply agreement with Eskom, which will define all the provisions around our bulk power supply from the national grid. So pricing mechanisms and all the rest of it. We'll work through getting those definitive agreements signed. But at this stage, under an MOU, we're pretty happy with what we've got with Eskom.
Yeah, absolutely. So what are the key advantages of securing this grid-based hydropower for the Kasia Rutile graphite project, you know, versus some sort of off-grid or, you know, a thermal solution?
Look, so the first thing is Malawi currently is not blessed with an amazing amount of electricity. There's about 351 megawatts total installed capacity throughout Malawi. We'll be using about 30 megawatts in phase one. Remember, Kasia is a two-phase or two-stage mine. So you have the first 5 years operating at 12 million tons per annum of throughput, and then years six through to year 25 at double that, so 24 million tons per annum. So obviously our power requirement doubles from one to the other. We'll start off in stage one at 30 megawatts and into a steady state at 60 megawatts, knowing that we can get that full 60 megawatts today from that 351 total installed capacity today gives a lot of security over electricity. You know, it's not like we can construct this mine and then someone plugs it into a wall somewhere and it gets up and running, right? We need to ensure that we are fully connected to the grid. It's working 24/7, and that's what we've laid out today.
Yeah, absolutely. And can you just elaborate a little bit on the sort of expected timeline for negotiating and signing the final project implementation, you know, potential power supply agreements on this?
Yeah, we've always said that we want to get to like a final investment decision. So that's your point where you say, right, stick a spade in the ground, let's get going. And whatever the future holds, you know, our objectives are to get to that decision within a 6 to 9 month period following the DFS announcement.
Are there any broader implications of the hydropower storage project? So obviously, it's World Bank backed, but Malawi's energy infrastructure and its wider mining sector, obviously, Kasia is, you know, the largest mining project in the country. But is it going to bring mining, you know, to Malawi on a bigger scale, would you say?
So a couple of things. Firstly, I just want to clarify, we don't need that project up and running to supply electricity to Kasia.
Okay.
What that project does do is it essentially doubles the electricity capacity of Malawi from 350 megawatts to 700 megawatts. So, so ultimately what we're saying is that security, that reliability, that enhanced capacity is a massive positive for us. And the backers of that project, you know, you're talking about, yes, you've seen the World Bank stroke the IFC come in with a $350 million grant. That's not a loan, it's a grant to get this thing up and running. And the guys behind it, I mean, you know, EDF, a well-known energy company, Total, well-known energy company. You've got the UK's DFI, British International Investment, essentially the UK government, got a Norfund, so essentially the Norwegian Parliament, all behind this. Those are big boys who want to see Malawi up and running. And I think within our RNS today, we actually included a quote where, you know, the World Bank Division Director for Malawi actually commented and said that this hydropower project is going to be a game changer for Malawi. And he particularly talked about the productive economic sectors for Malawi, which are agriculture, tourism, and lo and behold, mining.
Well, what size, what part of the economy will Kasia make up of Malawi?
Yeah,
once, once it's operational.
Going through from first operation through to steady state, all things being equal, we'd expect Kasia to be anywhere between 5 and 10% of Malawi's GDP, which means it's a very important project for the country and for the players who are there to equip Malawi with all the infrastructure it needs to get its mining industry up and running.
What other mining things could happen in Malawi, do you think? I mean, obviously, you've gone in and looked for initially for graphite and then stumbled over rutile, and it's now the biggest rutile discovery in 90 years or whatever. And the graphite, what else is available in Malawi? Because you did have other licenses in Malawi that were split off as well, didn't you?
Yeah, look, there's other graphite players in Malawi, but I think the most advanced out of the lot is another ASX-listed company called Lotus Resources, and they in the midst of restarting a uranium project in the north of Malawi. And you know, they've been following the well-trodden path within Malawi in terms of getting a mine development agreement signed with the government, which is not too different from what is in the tax laws and the Mining Act. They, I don't know what their time frame is, but they are very much probably going to be the first ones in production in Malawi. And that's a restart of an old uranium project which went into care and maintenance post Fukushima. But with you know the uranium prices and the uranium markets doing what they have done over the past kind of 18 months, they see a lot of value in that.
And going back the way when we discussed this maybe over a year ago now, the concept was that you're going to have a big field, or more than a field probably, of solar panels to do the electricity. So what changed to make that not the case?
So when we were initially put out a pre-feasibility study in September 23, we envisaged a solar farm next to, basically over the wall from our processing plants. We wanted to ensure that we were using mostly renewable energy in our mining and processing electricity requirements or energy requirements. As we've worked with our strategic partner Rio Tinto and optimized that PFS, a couple of things that have really come to the forefront are lowering the potential execution risk of the project, i.e. making sure that any kind of risk factors to get that project, the project up and running, are mitigated as much as possible, and the operational flexibility of the project, i.e. we can add or take away certain things from the project, have been quite key. So by the time we had the optimized PFS out in January, we had moved away from having that project on project risk of we need someone to build this solar farm in order for us to have a secure electricity, to now being able to just connect directly to a hydropowered grid and have that renewable electricity. You know, just anecdotally, four or five years ago, had you come on site, had you come to Malawi, you'd probably find the power goes out every four or five hours. The power hasn't gone out in Malawi for at least the last 2.5 years now. And that's mainly due to an interconnector between Mozambique and Malawi. So Mozambique are feeding a lot of electricity, spare capacity of electricity into Malawi. That's going directly into the grid. And what it means is that, you know, we have that secure electricity supply, which is why we believe, and our strategic investor Rio Tinto also believes that connecting directly into that grid provides us with a low execution risk option for getting electricity to Kaseya.
Yeah, and living in Egypt, I can sort of say to you, my electricity goes off at least once or twice every week, a minimum. So, you know, in African countries, it happens. It's a fact, you know. But to say that they've got the regular electricity, it's very good. I mean, South Africa, as you said, I was going to ask you the question about the provider there, because I didn't want it to be the same one as in South Africa, because that's an absolute disaster.
Fortunately, just a naming coincidence, but there's no, apart from the name, there's no overlap.
And from the perspective of the group and the company, this will be my last question. The scenario of you go in this alone to make more money, is it a possibility?
If I was sat here and I was hanging all the hopes of our shareholders and, you know, directors and everyone on a potential bid, potential M&A, some kind of exit strategy, I mean, I would not be doing my job, right? That is not what we're here as Sovereign Metals to do. Our job is to advance the project and continue advancing it. The value creation may come from building and putting this into production. It may come from M&A, it may come from a vast array of other corporate actions. But as far as we're concerned, we're just moving ahead with this project. Our focus is on the DFS. We get that DFS out. At that point, Rio Tinto has 180 days to opt to become operator of the project, according to our investment agreement. On day 181, post the announcement, Rio Tinto's, let's call them protections within our investment agreement, they all fall by the wayside and they just become a plain vanilla shareholder. We get to go out and sign offtake agreements and funding packages with whoever we like at that point in time.
So basically this time next year, a decision will have been made. You don't have to answer that question.
Though he won't. But I mean, I just, you know, just something that caught my eye on the RNS. You know, we're comparing sort of the 25-year life of mine. Kaseya is set to produce an average of 222,000 tons of natural rutile and 233,000 tons of natural flake graphite per annum. You know, so stacking up against sort of other sort of projects like Iluka or Base or Syrah, you are genuinely looking at becoming the largest producer of rutile and natural flake graphite. And, you know, based on all the data that you have, the rutile obviously speaks for itself, but the graphite you can produce at a cheaper cost than China. So are you potentially going to flood the graphite market? I mean, that's potentially a risk as well, maybe.
I mean, we could if we wanted, and we'd still make profits out of it at our cost levels, right?
Yeah.
What's the graphite market today? It's about 1.6 million tons of flake graphite concentrate.
Yeah.
China, depending on the source you look at, but China's about 1.2 million tons. So there's a little bit of room, but we'd be about 250,000 tons of flake graphite, as you said, going into that market. Remember, with our graphite though, we've shown that our graphite can end up in a lithium ion battery, which can end up in an electric vehicle if you so want, but it can also be used for all the good old industrial uses that 1.6 million tons of graphite, you know, most, like I'd say at least half of that still is used for those industrial uses, you know, refractories, foundry,
pencils,
crucibles, expandables, all that kind of good stuff. What does that mean for us? It means we are not here waiting for some hockey stick of a world of net zero and, you know, electrification and all that in order to be able to sell our graphite into the future. What we're here saying is, even if the graphite world didn't move that fast, you know, we're still able to sell our graphite into those existing industries, which then, you know, cater for the cement industry, the steel industry, the copper making industry, the all sorts, right? Aggregates. They're industries that are going to be here whether we're net zero or not.
Yeah.
So for me, it's not a case of, again, pinning my hopes on this one potential trajectory of an energy transition. If it works today, I know it'll work in 5 years' time. I know it'll work in 10 years' time. I know it'll work in 50 years' time.
Yeah, I think this is the key thing, isn't it? Because you're working off the basis of a 25-year life of mine. But I mean, I imagine you're thinking this thing will probably last a lot longer than that, right?
Yeah, and look, there's so many unknowns in this world right now in terms of just technical applications. We've been hounded with so much information on AI and robotics coming into the mining sphere as well. Yeah, whatever the mine looks like, all I'm going to say is whatever the mine looks like, in 2030 is not what it's going to look like in 2055 or 2070, because we're just making massive leaps and bounds on the energy front. But having said that, the actual commodities in the ground, the rutile and the graphite, we're going to still need those no matter where we end up.
Yeah, and I would say with the graphite, obviously it's the second largest graphite deposit in the world, as far as I remember. But the rutile is, the last rutile find before you guys were the 1970s, 1980s, off the top of my head. So
Yeah.
you're not going to find another one, I think is the key point, or you're unlikely to.
Look, I think after we found Cassia, a lot of explorers went out looking for similar looking deposits, and they've come across
Can I just correct you that after you fell across Cassia, because you didn't find it, you found graphite.
after we academically
If
discovered Cassia.
you have to admit your complete luck in finding Cassia, and then everyone will believe you.
You
know
know,
what? So I told this anecdote at an investor conference recently. But I went to about three weekends ago. I took my kids to the UK's National Space Centre, and three shocking discoveries. Right, first one that the UK has a National Space Centre. Secondly, that it's in Leicester of all places. And thirdly was we learned about this thing called the Hubble Deep Field. And I don't know if you know this, but in 1995, NASA space scientists pointed the Hubble Space Telescope at an empty part of space, right? They wanted to understand emptiness, they wanted to understand darkness, and they left it there for 10 days, like a really tiny dot. I think, at the space center, there was a plaque saying it was like holding a grain of sand at arm's length. That small. What they found after 10 days, when they looked at the image, they found like thousands of galaxies and billions of unknown stars all of a sudden just appear in this empty, tiny part of space. And it completely changed their viewpoint of what is out there in terms of that emptiness of space. And my point to the audience at this investor conference is sometimes the biggest, most important discoveries you make is while you're not even looking for them. And that's exactly what happened with Cassia. We were out there looking for graphite, and whoops, here's a whole bunch of rutile.
I imagine there's when you found it, or even shortly after you found it, anyone with a graphite deposit was something like, hang on, let's just check there's no rutile buried underneath it.
No, look, so going back to what I was going to say, I think there is a bit of a titanium rush going on in the markets right now with the on the exploration side, people knowing that there is a huge structural deficit in rutile supply coming, that we are massively reliant on ilmenite and upgrading that to get specifically titanium metal out, and that titanium metal is being used for reindustrialization, unfortunately re-weaponization of the Western world as well, quote unquote. There's a massive move towards the use of titanium, and obviously we've seen, the aerospace industry is getting bigger, defense industry is getting bigger. There's uses within commercial aspects, and all the new iPhones are now titanium as well, if you want. But it's very titanium's everywhere, right? You could go to Hyde Park, get a bunch of some of the green nettles from the hedges out, and you could probably get a bit of titanium out of them, right? Because nettles are high in titanium. But not all titanium can be used for its end uses, whether that's pigments, whether that's welding, whether that's titanium sponge. It's very hard to find commercially viable rutile, ilmenite, essentially titanium minerals in the ground. They're everywhere, but getting them out and turning them into something useful is a whole different story. That's why the first thing we did when we found rutile at Cassia was send it away to all the usual suspects in the titanium world. I mean, this is what got Rio interested in the first place. We sent it to all loads of end users, and they all came back and said, this is good stuff. This works for us.
Very good. So
Well,
What are the next steps? What are we going to hear from you next?
Look, so we're doing a bunch of work around future offtake agreements, some collaboration that we're doing with, not to sound like an Instagram influencer or anything, but, you know, some collaboration agreements with some big names, shall we say, within the industry. We're working on getting the mineral resource estimate updated and getting that out in the next few weeks. And obviously, we continue working on the DFS, which we're hoping to get out in Q4. So that will include de-risking other parts of it, as we have done with the power today.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. This is a monumental day. I think, as you said at the beginning, this is a Man United face Tottenham in the Europa League final. So what give us your predictions for the game?
Come on, you Spurs!
8-0, Man United.
Come on, you Spurs!
Oh, no, look, we're bound to let one or two in, right? Bananas are bound to
let
one
seven,
or two
in. It's going to be 7-6,
I think. I'm going 2-1 United. I mean, they've beaten us three times this season already, but, yeah, we're going to have to get a win in.
I think 2-1's a good one. I think, you know, Maguire had a 93rd minute.
I'm going 3-2 Spurs. Son scores in the 91st minute. Charles, take your pick.
Go. Do you know what? I'll be calling, I reckon, Spurs. 2-1, they're going to win.
Oh,
and we've got a bit of
everything. But
there.
The more likely scenario is it's 3-3 and then it goes to penalties. Or
penalties. Yeah.
Always the way, yeah.
Isn't it the last three out of the four finals have gone to penalties?
Yeah.
Do you not think, though, that like when it's two teams from the same country, right, there should be contingency planning so that they host the final in the country of the teams rather than they get on a boat to Bilbao?
There was a guy on the news this morning saying that he was in the hotel last night. It was £76 equivalent of the hotel. And tonight it's £2,300 for the same hotel. But it's just absolute crazy.
Yeah.
You'd be sleeping on the bench, never mind.
Exactly. You wouldn't even book the room. You'd just stay.
The room. There's some great campsites in Bilbao. I'd just bring a picture tent. I mean, often, genuinely, I've done this before many times. The campsites never put up their prices, but the hotels always do.
Yeah.
Just so if you're already there for one or two nights, like really, just bring a tent, especially in the summer. People never really think of that, though.
Indeed. Anyway, I hope you both, you Sapa and Phil, are extremely unhappy later on this evening, and I'll have a smile on my face. But you never know.
Looking like a true Scouser.
Come on, Spurs. Well, we have some Spurs fans that we look. We've got Charles Bray's big Spurs fan. One of the guys in the brokerage, big Spurs. So yeah, we will see. And all the Arsenal fans will be cheering for you anyway. So don't worry.
Of course, yeah, that's good of them. All right. Well, on that note, we'll say Sapangai, CCO of Sovereign Metals. Thanks very much for appearing back on the podcast.
It's been a pleasure, gents. Thanks for having me.
Cheers.
This podcast was brought to you by Roast PR Limited. If you would like to appear on a future episode of The Sunday Roast, please email admin@thesundayroast.net.